There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the best bits of today's show from Tuesday, December the 10th.
I want to be a billionaire so freaking bad.
So bad.
Buy all of the things I never had.
I want to be a billionaire so freaking bad. So we thought we'd ask a billionaire how to do it. And handily, one of them has just written a book. He's Steve Schwarzman. He's the founder of Blackstone, the world's biggest private equity company. And his book is published recently. It's called What It Takes. And it tells his story about he went from being a middle-class guy in Philadelphia to being one of the world's richest people, but also offers some tips along the way. I spoke to him a couple of days ago about this, and I've picked out some of the highlights. And for me, one of the key quotes, and lots of people have picked up the quote, and he says, you can learn to be a manager. You can even learn to be a leader, but you can't learn to be an entrepreneur. And he gives the example of his dad, who had, back in the 50s, a successful shop in Philadelphia selling bed linen and curtains and so on. And he said, but let's take this regional, let's take this across the United States. And his dad just wasn't interested. And that, as Steve Schwarzman explains, is the difference that he noticed.
I thought if we expanded this business on a national basis, we could not only do well where we were, but it would be an infinitely bigger, more impactful organization. There was at that time no national chain of similar stores. One eventually was created in the United States called Bed Bath and Beyond. You know, I just thought that was a natural thing to do, and I talked to my father about it, and he said he didn't have any interest. And then I said, well, you know, you wouldn't even have to travel if we just opened another 6 or 7 locations in Philadelphia, which was the city. And he said he didn't want to do that. So I finally said, I said, Dad, why don't you want to do this? He said, I have everything I need now. I'm very happy. He said, I've got a house, 2 cars, and enough savings to send you and your brothers to university. He just simply didn't have the aspiration or the appetite for adventure. And, you know, he was a truly happy person. That's why I loved him. And he was extremely smart, much smarter than I am as a person. But, you know, he just lacked that desire. And so I've always had that ability to, like, assess an environment and see some huge opportunity. And my nature is I go for it if it's a really big thing.
Well, he spent a lot of time in the Middle East. Most, many, perhaps even all of the big sovereign wealth funds are investors in one way or the other in Blackstone and its funds. And this is Steve Schwarzman telling us what he's learned doing business in the Middle East.
I started going there in 1992. The area has exploded with capital. What I've learned about the Middle East, because I love going there, and there's enormous stability in the people who are in their positions and the people who are below them who grow up to take those positions. And so there's a real sense of partnership and trust that develops if you're open, honest, mean well, and do well. You know, there's a nice social component. When you go to the Middle East, people like to spend time with you. You know, you develop deep friendships and people have dinners at their home. And the relationship isn't strictly technical in terms of just managing money. It becomes a much broader kind of friendship where people will call and ask for advice on things. And, you know, some of it's even about their children. And you become part of the lives of a lot of the people that you do business with, but it's a more personal and respectful and more emotionally accessible relationship than you have almost anywhere in the world.
So it's a cracking book, What It Takes, by Steve Schwarzman. Some amazing stories, but also some real good life lessons as well. At the end of it, handily, he writes what he calls his 25 rules for work and life. Now, I'm not going to read out all 24, but here are a couple that I took away. So if you would like to be a billionaire, this is what you have to do. Number 4, Brandy Scott, there is nothing more interesting to people than their own problems. Think about what others are dealing with and try to come up with ideas to help them. So that is one way to be successful. What else have we got? Number seven, probably too late for us, but he says, when you're young, only take a job that provides you with a steep learning curve and strong training. First jobs are foundational. Don't take a job just because it seems prestigious. And the two more, I'm going to give two more. Number eight, when presenting yourself, remember that impressions matter. The whole picture has to be right. Others will be watching for all sorts of clues that tell who you are. Be three things: on time, authentic, and prepared. And finally, not about yourself, but when you're hiring people, when you're recruiting people, hire tens whenever you can. People who are 10 out of 10 in what they do. He says they are proactive about sensing problems, designing solutions, and taking a business in new directions. They also attract and hire other tens. You can always build something around a 10. That is Steve Schwarzman. His 25 Rules for Life. The book is out now. What It Takes.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Saudi Arabia is scrapping gender segregation in restaurants. Joining us in the studio to give some perspective, Andre Gershel, Regional Director of Operations at Baker & Spice. You've had restaurants in Saudi Arabia for a while now. How big a deal is this?
So, look, our parent company, which is based in Kuwait, has had restaurants there for quite some time, but we're actually foraying into the Baker & Spice brand, hopefully in Q1 of next year in Jeddah to start off. And I think there's a lot of interesting things about this. Number one, I'll tell you what I'm most excited about in terms of this idea of desegregation in Saudi Arabia. I wonder if this is going to lead to more participation in the kitchen and in the labor force of restaurants. That's what I think I'm most interested in. I'm not so surprised, to be honest, with all of the sort of avant-garde reform that's coming out of Saudi Arabia, that this is the move that they've taken. I actually find it sort of one of the more decaf reforms, so to speak, of all the things that have happened. What I'm most interested in is because as a brand director, we have to hire a lot of Saudis. And getting Saudis to work in non-traditional fields is tough. It's going to take some time, I think, to encourage them. But I wonder if this desegregation element is going to allow for more young Saudi Arabian citizens to participate in the restaurant business, not just as owners or brand developers, but physically, you know, doing the work in kitchens and on the floors of restaurants.
Will it affect the way, I mean, presumably you're built, designed, what stage are you at?
So we are under construction. The furniture has been ordered as of yesterday. I'm hoping that we're going to be open within the next sort of 120, maybe a little bit after that, 120 days.
So what does it affect for you opening up? Will it affect, I mean, presumably if you were looking at screens or whatever, it's not like you've got structural renovations in there, but will it affect the marketing? Will it affect the way you go about your business at all?
It completely affects the marketing. Even the way that we would shoot food and the ambiance of the restaurant itself, photography, the marketing direction of that. But I think, you know, it's also baby steps a little bit, right? Because just because a law is passed doesn't mean that people are necessarily ready to embrace it. There's still going to be a lot of traditional elements to Saudi society. And I think it's important that we remember that. Great, women can drive now, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all parents want their daughters driving yet. So we have to really measure it carefully. But I think, you know, we're going to be opening up in Jeddah. Jeddah, the expression in Arabic is that Jeddah is different. And it really is a different city than the rest of Saudi Arabia in many different ways. And I think this type of reform is exciting. You have Aramco, who's going to start trading on Wednesday for the first time. There's a lot of change and shift and reinvestment socially and financially into the country. Tourist visas. There's so much going on right now, and I think overall it bodes beautifully for the restaurant industry.
Well, you say bodes beautifully for the restaurant industry. Let's talk more broadly about that sector, looking back on 29 and annus horribilis, a tough year for many restaurants and cafes in Dubai. What's been your assessment of the sector as a whole and how that's performed as a member of that industry? And then what can you tell us about how Baker & Spice has done in 2019 versus the year before?
So look, it is a tremendously challenging time. And I think you're starting to see a lot of positive friction between tenants and landlords. I think that's a big sort of nexus point right now of friction, where landlords have to reevaluate what their expectations are from tenants, and tenants can start sort of asking more of landlords. And I've gone on the air and sort of railed about this a lot, but landlords need to really think about a 10-year spread and start really investing back in their tenants. But I think...
And cheaper rents as well. And
right. I mean, that's what it comes down to, is much cheaper rents. But I also think it's a call to action for developers, because now what you have is, let's say the average restaurant space was 3,000 square feet, 2,500 square feet. Now they're building micro units. And really the answer to saturation, which is what we've spoken about so many times, is building something smaller, is building something that's so micro and so neighborhood and beautifully sunlit that what you have is lots of small, beautiful places that answer the problem of saturation, answer the problems of high overheads, and ultimately keep tenants in places for longer periods of time. And I think that's the only way to address the correction that's required in our industry.
So in terms of the sweet spot of size of restaurants, if you're opening in 2020 here in Dubai, it's not the 2,500, 3,000 square meter restaurant that we were talking about before. Or 2,500 square meter or square feet?
Square feet. Square meter would be ambitious.
That would be colossal, wouldn't it?
although there are certain DIFC restaurants, which I won't name, which have done that, which I find ambitious.
But no, 2,500, 3,000 square feet. What are we going to be looking at when you're opening in 2020 and beyond?
So look, at the moment, we're looking at very specific franchise deals. And one of the ways that we've addressed current market conditions is, you know, this new property that we're doing in Jeddah is an amazing partnership with a company called Pure House Hotels. And basically, we've taken over the all-day dining. So instead of having your traditional all-day dining outlet in the base floor of a hotel, it's going to be a branded baker and spice unit. And so that's a partnership element. But for, you know, the ones that we own, I would say that we're really looking at 200, 300, even 400 square feet or 50 square meter, if you prefer, outlets that are very small.
That's tiny.
Tiny. Yeah. Really, really tiny. We have a great partnership that's coming up with NMC Clinics, where we're building a very tiny sort of small baker and spice inside their hospital units. And that's been really effective for us.
I love that, because that means you're going to have healthy food inside a hospital, aren't you?
Yeah, and actually what we're going to do is reorient. And look, my real goal is that if we're going to build smaller and we're going to become leaner, then we should also be cheaper, right? We should have the opportunity to pass that discount on to the customers and address the fact that, as the earnings report that we just heard, is that, you know, our disposable income is going to feel smaller for a little bit until things correct themselves. So we need to address that as well.
So are you cutting prices on some of your menus?
I certainly am not going to commit to that quite yet, but I would definitely like to create opportunities for people to get more value out of my brand.
What would that mean? Would it mean maybe not cutting prices of existing dishes? An omelette goes from 40 to 35 dirhams, but does it mean inventing new menu items that are lower priced?
Absolutely. But I also think it's about recalibrating portion size for, you know, specific dishes. I think people are okay with different size meals now. Grab and go is a much more appropriate way of doing things, and even limited service. So for example, what I'll do now is I'll say there's limited service at certain branches where you just have to go to the counter and kind of do a little bit more of the work yourself. But in exchange for doing that, you're going to get a 10 to 15, maybe even a 20% discount on some of the dishes.
Talk to us a little bit more about the grab and go market, because this is one that in the States, particularly in the UK, and in fact in my native New Zealand, is huge. The restaurant meals already portioned up, walk in, pick them up, take them home.
Yeah, I mean, look, as a cook by background, the grab-and-go model of prepared foods in advance sort of hurts me a little bit, only because I love the art of cooking, and I really think that the amazing thing about Baker and Spice is it's really an extension of people's fridge. So they literally show up and they kind of like, oh, well, what's in my fridge tonight? Which has been amazing. We're a very neighborhood, resident-oriented restaurant company, with the exception of the Souq al-Bahar branch. But I think, it makes sense. If you're able to build a central kitchen, one, and you have the ability to leverage that, it makes a lot of sense to do these grab-and-go models. And I think it's all about the existing resources that you have. So if you have, for example, a central kitchen, it's much easier to have a food truck or a small grab-and-go outlet or any one of these pop-up opportunities that you're seeing proliferate across the UAE right now.
You said food truck.
I did.
Because?
I said food truck because I think it's, you know, people talked a lot about that. It was sort of a buzzword 3 years ago. I think everybody got really excited about it. And there were huge numbers being thrown about the food truck industry and how it's going to, you know, quadruple. And I think the problem was we couldn't really figure out who the stakeholders were in the beginning. Was it the RTA? Was it civil defense? Was it Dubai Municipality? And now it's sort of regulated itself. But food trucks are the perfect sort of outlet and grab-and-go concept for existing restaurant companies. I think it was initially supposed to be somewhat more oriented towards entrepreneurs in the food business, but it's sort of transitioned to big box companies like even Shake Shack, who now have a food truck.
Andre, great talking to you. Appreciate your time. Andre Gershul is the Regional Director of Operations at Baker & Spice. Nice to see you.
Pleasure.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Joining us in the studio to go through the tabloids, the broadsheets, and of course the ARN News Centre app is Sanu Sharif from the ARN News Centre. We'll get to your stories in a second, including telephones and Dubai residency, but first, a DJ. Who's he and what's he doing on the Business Breakfast?
That is David Solomon. He's the CEO of Goldman Sachs, has been for just over a year, but on the weekends, he's D-Soul.
That is his collaboration with the DJ Zecco and Kool & the Gang.
We're not so much talking about his DJing, though. We're talking about his robo-advisory.
Okay. Back to business.
Back to business. FT headline this morning is that Goldman Sachs, who normally deal with people who have a lot of money, are going to start dealing with people who do not have a lot of money.
Why did Goldman want to mess around with the great unwashed like me?
Do you know what? There's a lot of theories, but as such, they haven't said. This is what we do know, that they're looking to launch a robo-advisor. So an algorithm-based investing service, if you like. We have a couple here in the region for people who have as little as $5,000 to invest.
I don't know. Sanuj, what do you make of this? Goldman Sachs, the most elite investment bank in the world, certainly on Wall Street. Should they be going after the likes of me, you and Brandy?
I think, you know, a big name behind it, it does sound appealing and I would give it a try. I mean, because it's a big name behind it and it's uncharted territory for them. And if they're offering something different, then why not? You know, I would be definitely keen to give it a try.
Sanuj makes a good point, which is that if you were investment shy, if you were risk adverse, you'd probably be more likely to trust a name like Goldman Sachs with your $5,000 or your $10,000.
Well, I have a different...
And I speak about myself here.
We're very much in that category. I have a different thesis. And my thesis is this. If I was an owner of Goldman Sachs shares, and it's a listed company, this would concern me. And I'll give you the parallel of Rolls-Royce. The whole point of Rolls-Royce and the cachet of the brand is that they are rare and exclusive. And if you've got a roller, you're clearly the bee's knees. If, however, Rolls-Royce start churning out 50,000 dirham hatchbacks and they're all over the roads of Dubai, suddenly the high rollers and the captains of industry won't want a Rolls-Royce anymore because you devalue the brand. And I fear that over the medium to long term with Goldman Sachs, this might erode the brand value. This and things like the tie-up with Apple for credit cards, I'm not sure.
Look, the tie-up with Apple for credit cards didn't go exactly according to plan. I mean, it did in the fact that a lot of people have taken them up, but they have had some bad publicity as well with the credit card accused of being sexist. Well, the algorithms behind it accused of being sexist. I think this is a good move. Some are wondering if Goldman is looking at kind of a pipeline for future customers. I don't necessarily think that's it, but it certainly does expand their base. And I mean, you know, the fintech is coming on the investment advisory side. I guess I see this as a, if you can't beat them, join them.
The casting vote goes to a 99 dirham bottle of perfume.
It does, because the reason I don't think that your car analogy holds is because diffusion brands are nothing new. I am wearing today a perfume called Ebony Woods that cost me 99 dirhams. It was a Jo Malone tie-up with Zara. It wouldn't stop me or anyone else, I don't think, necessarily buying the original Jo Malone or Jo Loves perfumes, just because at the moment you can buy a cheap version.
And typically they're, what, 500-600 dirhams starting out, those kind of perfumes?
Exactly. And this is different. And it's not, I mean, it's not the main ones, but they're very nice, actually. I bought three, and because I'm like that with perfume. But it's, everyone does it. Armani's got AX, haven't they? I mean, Donna Karan's got DKNY. I don't think that it stops people from buying the main stuff. You, I saw you walked around all day yesterday with the label of your jumper poking out. By the way, none of us bothered to tell you, but I know it said AX on it.
Yeah, I thought I was being quite swanky and highbrow wearing an Armani jumper, but clearly not.
No.
So now you tell us about residence visas in Dubai. We can get them much more quickly.
Yes, it's getting a lot easier for people in Dubai to apply or renew their UAE residency visa. The process, it seems, can now be completed within 40 minutes through the Dubai Now app. This app has been around for quite some time, offering various government services, but this particular feature, the
Malcolm
residency...
Malcolm Taylor was an unofficial brand ambassador of that.
Yeah, I mean, he was speaking about it a couple of times on the show, because there are various government services that the app offers, and this particular feature, the residency visa feature, was launched last month, and officials say users can complete the application within just 10 minutes, and it takes between 30 minutes and 2 working days for it to be approved.
Okay, that sounds pretty quick, doesn't it? I mean, I remember it being several weeks of a thing, and, you know, particularly for people who did a lot of work trips, you would have to plan work trips around it, because you would know if you're getting your residence visa renewed that you were going to have, a week, 10 days, maybe longer, where you just couldn't book anything because this process would be happening.
Yeah, so what they're saying is that if all your documents are in order, it'll take a minimum of just 40 minutes and maximum of 2 working days. And not just that, the app also helps applicants save nearly 200 dirhams on every new application, 100 dirham on renewals, and those charges usually went towards printing fees, so they can save that money as well.
Good stuff, Sunil Sharif from the Aero News Centre. Always nice talking to you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We are talking hospitality this morning. A Nepalese company is expanding into Dubai with a very distinctive hotel. We're going to find out why now with Rahul Chowdhury, who's the Managing Director of CG Corp. It's lovely to see you, Rahul. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
As a representative of Nepal's first and only billion-dollar corporation, do you actually just want to tell us who CG Corp is for people who don't know?
Yeah, CG Corp is a family-owned business with a 150-year-old history. In short, we are in over 40 different countries around the world, in 15 different business sectors, from FMCG to banking to education to Hyderabad, telecom, real estate, and hospitality being one of our largest space. And we are a family of over 10,000 employees all over the world, and growing so every single day.
And the hotel that's bringing you into Dubai is Taj Jumeirah Lake Towers.
Absolutely.
A very distinctive hotel, which we'll get to in a moment. I know Richard's all over the architecture. Why do you want a hotel in Dubai?
You know, we entered the Dubai market almost 15 years back, but Dubai, I mean, hospitality business is a very, very niche and peculiar business where location is the most important thing. We looked at multiple different opportunities all across Dubai itself and watched the market evolve over a period of time, going through the ups and downs, the cycles. And finally, we locked in on Jumeirah Lake Towers because we felt that the market is slowly shifting towards the business luxury segment. And we already know the uprise in terms of the foreign investors and companies that come into GLT itself. And we felt that was the right market to be in.
And this is a hotel that you've built from the ground up?
Absolutely. So this is a bespoke luxury Taj product, which has taken us 4 to 5 years of time to build.
We know this is a tough time to be opening a hotel in Dubai. When you conceived of this idea 4 or 5 years ago, hotel room rates were booming in 2014. It was the top of the market. And I'm sure that the business models and the spreadsheets that you drew up had hotel room rates at 1,000+ dirhams a night. I've just done the same test on your hotel. What's a room going to cost me next Tuesday night? We did it for the Scotland Yard Hotel in London. That was 2,000 dirhams a night. In your hotel, on one of the booking sites, it's just over 600 dirhams a night. How are the economics stacking up in this new reality?
Well, like you said, Richard, that when we decided to come into started to develop the hotel, the market was completely different. And of course, the market has evolved. And now we feel that we are getting into the right time in the right season, which is going to lead on to the expo. And I'm quite confident, and we all are quite confident, looking at the current location and the timing that we are getting into the market space. Of course, the rates that we are offering are at the moment introductory rates to get in the traffic into the door, but we are quite confident that these rates are only going to move up with the season leading on to the expo and the general business traffic itself that comes into Dubai all the time.
I mean, you say you're confident, but clearly you've been in this business an awfully long time in various countries, in your home country of Nepal, in India, in the Maldives and elsewhere. So you're nobody's fool. I mean, confidence and hope is not a strategy, is it? There's massive supply in the Dubai hotel market. Do you genuinely believe that this time next year it's going to be 800-900 dirhams a night in your hotel rather than 600-ish?
Absolutely. That's why I said that we chose this location after a lot of due diligence. And we obviously, I mean, looking at where we are in terms of the segment of the hospitality, in terms of the brand itself, we are focusing on the business luxury, which is your above your mid-market. So your rates are always going to be between your 800 to 1,000 dirham. And like I said, expo, we hope, of course, I mean, you work around a hope that the rates are going to always move up. But because of the location and because of what's coming into the market, one feels that the numbers are going to stack up and look more confident.
Expo's for a fixed time afterwards. What's your strategy post-expo?
I think the business traffic is going to continue. I think the expo is going to give a push that the Dubai market needs in terms of the traffic coming in, more so from the business side. So I think this push is necessary for you to be able to maintain your occupancies and rates, which are seemingly low at the moment. But I think that push is going to continue post the Dubai Expo, as I'd also seen when I went to the big Shanghai Expo a few years back, and we know where China is at the moment.
So in terms of the business model, we've seen the pictures of the hotel. You've clearly spent a lot of money on it. The architecture is pretty iconic. I likened it to a large Jenga set, but a market Jenga set. The interior, you've clearly spent a lot of money on. What's the payback period? Because you're the owner of the bricks and mortar on a property like this.
Absolutely. We are looking at ourselves from a feasibility point of view. We look at typically 5 years or so for the payback period. And considering the current Dubai market, as you said, that's a pretty good timeline for a payback, and that's being optimist. That's I would say us being realist more so. There are hotels that we have done over some places all around the world where we've even made our money back in 3 years. But we feel because of the current supply, as you mentioned yourself, and obviously the hope that the influx is going to continue after the expo, we are quite comfortable looking at the F&B offerings, including the leader in the market in the space that we are in, that we should be able to get back our investment during that time.
Rahul Chowdhury, Managing Director of CG Corp. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That's it for the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back live on air tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.